This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 1st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
At some point, did you make a 911 call?
That is correct. Did call the police on the police.
Right. And why did you do that?
Because I believe I witnessed a murder.
And so you felt a need to call the police?
I felt the need to call the police on the police.
Now, there were police there, right?
There were police there.
Okay. Why didn't you just talk to them about it?
I believe that we just didn't have no connection. You know, I spoke to them, but not on a connection of a human being relationship.
Donald Williams was one of the bystanders who witnessed the death of George Floyd on May 25th last year. This week, Williams and several other witnesses are testifying at the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged in the case. The death of George Floyd touched off a nationwide protest movement and a new reckoning with systemic racism in America. Chauvin's trial has reignited discussions about these issues. At the same time, Georgia and other Republican states are working to restrict Black access to the polls. Last week, Governor Brian Kemp signed into law a bill designed to impede voting, particularly by African Americans. President Biden described it as Jim Crow in the 21st century. Jelani Cobb, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the national political fallout from Floyd's killing and how to think about the new wave of voter suppression efforts across the country. Hi, Jelani. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
You are quite closely following the trial of Derek Chauvin, which is sure to be a landmark murder case. What specifically are you looking for in the trial itself and also in the public conversation about it?
So I think there are two tracks. You know, one is the kind of detailed forensic examination of the facts that each side has done. And, you know, there are information, lots of great journalism has been done around what happened on May 25th of last year. But there's information that's been withheld from the public. And so you're looking for some of that to come out. One of the first things that happened, you know, at the very outset of the trial was that there was a change in the amount of time. The 8-minute, 46-second mantra, almost, for the amount of time that the video lasted that we saw of Derek Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck. In fact, we learned that Derek Chauvin had been kneeling on his neck for a total of 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And that brings us to the second thing that is really pertinent about the trial, which is the cause of death. And even, you know, at the outset, you know, kind of early on, you're seeing one side maintaining that George Floyd died as a direct result of actions that were taken by Derek Chauvin, and the other side saying that George Floyd was someone who had a history of substance abuse and who succumbed as a result of long-term drug use compounded by whatever was in his system. And so it's just a mere coincidence that he happened to have been on the ground with an officer kneeling on his neck at the time that he succumbed. Essentially, that's the defense argument.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that's been so extraordinary is listening to the really emotional testimony from a number of young witnesses for the prosecution, the teenager who recorded the key video of Floyd's arrest, the cashier at Cup Foods who took Floyd's suspected counterfeit bill, and that 9-year-old girl. And yesterday, another witness sobbed as he watched the footage, saying he'd pleaded with Floyd to get into the police car because, as he said, you can't win. Does that create an unusually sort of visceral reaction within the court and among the wider public, which is able to watch all of this?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're all shocked when we saw that video last year. And it seems as if the prosecution is trying to bring people back to that moment, that as alarming and traumatizing as that video was for all of us who saw it, you know, from a distant remove, imagine what this was like for people who witnessed it from a few feet away. And the person who you mentioned, the last one, Charles McMillan, was just sobbing and just undone on the stand, feeling, I imagine, some degree of guilt for saying, having talked to George Floyd and said, you know, you can't win. And then, you know, moments later, Floyd is on the ground. And, you know, 9 minutes after that, he's dead. And so it really is incredibly heart-wrenching. And there's a jury. There are 12 people who've seen that video just like we all did. And, you know, they're being brought back to the moment of May 25th, 2020 as well.
One of the many reasons I wanted to talk to you about all of this is a documentary you made in 2016 with Frontline, Policing the Police, in which you followed the attempts to reform the very troubled Newark Police Department. And then you returned last year in the wake of this past summer's protests. Could you tell us kind of how you see all of that, especially at this current moment?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, the Minneapolis Police Department and the Newark Police Department, you know, probably have very different reputations, but their track records or their histories of having issues and problems were not that dissimilar leading up to the moment that George Floyd died. You know, I've written about, you know, other high-profile instances of police use of force that resulted in someone's death in Minneapolis and surrounding areas. Probably the best known of those was Philando Castile, who was in Falcon Heights, a nearby suburb of Minneapolis. And, you know, Newark had that same sort of history, maybe not the same sort of high-profile instances, but a very troubled police department with years of community concerns that preceded it. And, of course, that catastrophic eruption that happened in 1967, which was the result of, you know, police use of force. And in 2016, they were at the outset of a process of trying to turn the corner, trying to change the police department into something different. And we didn't quite have the language of defund the police then. But by 2020, when we went back, that was very much what the city was invested in doing, particularly the mayor. And we should put a caveat on what we say, on what we mean by defund the police. Probably the worst defined slogan of 2020. In this instance, they were very much interested in finding alternative solutions to community problems, that not every issue required a law enforcement response. And in taking some portion, I believe it's about $5 million now, that has come out of the police budget to fund alternate community programs, whether those are mental health you know, programs or community-based violence intervention programs. And surprisingly, you have some degree of support among police for this. As a matter of fact, I've said many times, the first time I ever heard anything that could be remotely construed as defund the police, it came from a police officer in 2015 in Newark, who frankly said, "We do too much. You know, people ask us to do things that we are not good at, and then they get angry because we don't do them well. And there should be other groups and other organizations handling things that maybe don't fall directly in our purview." And so Newark has actually undertaken that, and with some degree of progress, you know, decreasing violent crime, decreasing homicide rates, and what seems to be a kind of growing, workable relationship among these various multifaceted aspects of community safety.
Well, that's heartening in a city like Newark. But what about Minneapolis? As I understand it, you know, city council members pledged to so-called defund the department and to put other measures into effect along the lines of what you're talking about in Newark. Has any of that come to fruition?
I hate to say it like this, but it's kind of yes and no. In the moment, people thought that this would happen very quickly. People were doing things like, you know, city councils, not just there, but across the country, taking votes to remove the police from local schools, and you could kind of snap your fingers and make that happen. But Minneapolis quickly found out that reimagining policing is a lot of work, and it's very complicated. But about 3 weeks ago, just about 3 weeks ago, the city council took a vote. Actually, there was a city vote that gave the city council the authority to create some sort of alternate policing system. And, you know, what that looks like is still being worked out. But, you know, on March 12th, they took another step toward creating something other than the MPD that's always been known.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
There.
When Biden was in the Senate, he helped to write the very controversial 1994 crime bill, which was passed at a time when crime was rising across the country. Critics say that it led the way to more aggressive policing and mass incarceration, disproportionately, as we know, of Black and brown men. Biden has denied some of that criticism, and during his presidential campaign, he often spoke about George Floyd's death, and he spoke by recording at Floyd's funeral service.
Now is the time for racial justice. That's the answer we must give to our children when they ask why. Because when there is justice for George Floyd, we will truly be on our way to racial justice in America. And then, as you said, Gianna, your daddy will have changed the world.
The White House press secretary recently said that he's closely watching the trial. Talk a little bit about Joe Biden's history on this subject and where you think he's going on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating that history would intervene in this way, that Joe Biden, the person who is primarily responsible for drafting the 1994 crime bill, would find himself president at a point where, one, that bill is widely unpopular now, even though there were some warranted things, the assault weapons ban, the consent decree program to give oversight to police departments. Those things are not really associated with the 1994 crime bill, although they were part of it. And he is now at a point where that bill is extremely unpopular. And there is an attitude that policing and criminal justice have gone off the rails. But I do think that there's a bit more connection between what happened in 1994 and maybe 2020 than we knew. The crime bill of 1994 was written as the embers of Los Angeles in 1992 were being put out. You know, people were very cognizant of what had happened to Rodney King. In the back of people's consciousness was this issue with police and policing, which is how the consent decree language came to be part of it. And that's now the primary tool that the Department of Justice has in pursuing reform in police departments that are chronically, as they say, with a pattern of practice of abuse or excessive use of force. And so I imagine that, you know, we've kind of seen a reversal, that now this has become the primary concern and this is, you know, where people are with it.
You know, it's interesting, too, that it's a racially diverse jury. And you couldn't have lived through last summer's demonstrations without being aware of, you know, what people were demanding, that this stop immediately. How significant do you think all of that will be in the Chauvin trial?
I think context matters. You know, everyone saw the video and not just a few people, millions of people were having conversations that they probably felt uncomfortable with, but were nonetheless necessary at their workplace, in their families, in their communities, in their churches. This was just the topic that could not be avoided. And the jury is drawn from that pool of people. What this will look like in the ultimate outcome, nobody knows. My just kind of armchair suspicion has been that there are two dynamics that are competing. One is this kind of consciousness-raising moment that we saw beginning on May 25th of last year. And the other is the institutional and social reluctance of juries to convict police officers, even in seemingly the most egregious circumstances. If we think about the litany of names of Tamir Rice, of Eric Garner, of Philando Castile, none of the police faced legal consequences in any of those circumstances. And so those two things are really the competing dynamics. And just my armchair speculation is there's probably a higher likelihood of a hung jury than there would have been otherwise.
So I can't let you go without asking you about Georgia, since you've done so much reporting from Georgia and about Georgia. And there, too, the foundational promise of equal justice under law is at stake. We saw in the past year extraordinary grassroots activism by Black-led groups, which boosted African-American turnout and helped to elect President Biden and two Democratic senators. Do you see a connection between the George Floyd protests and the Democrats' recent success?
Absolutely. If you heard from any of the people who were on the ground over the course of that year, they understood, you know, what happened in Minneapolis to be part of a bigger set of problems, which they lay directly at the feet of Donald Trump. Not that he created it, that it wasn't police brutality before, but his rhetoric and his kind of recalcitrance in the face of criticism and his consistent, inflaming of tensions in these ways and encouraging some of the worst behaviors in law enforcement really made it hard to not see George Floyd's death as an outgrowth of a bigger set of political problems that people were facing. Part of that gigantic turnout and particularly that gigantic Black turnout was directly attributable to, you know, what we've been calling the reckoning, you know, that happened last summer.
And predictably, there's been a gigantic backlash by Governor Kemp, as I mentioned at the top, with this bill he recently signed into law. Talk a little bit about that.
So Brian Kemp signed a bill into law, which has been controversial since it was introduced in the Georgia legislature, that makes it very difficult for people to vote by absentee mail. It also enhances the ID requirement, which has been shown to have racially disparate impacts in terms of difficulty in voting. You know, this has been transparent. People have seen right through it. And it's generated lots of controversy and a nascent call to boycott businesses in Georgia. And that may be the real consequence of this. You know, and the other irony here is, of course, a lot of what has been struck down in this law or prohibited in this law had been put into law by Republicans in the state in the first place. And so really, this seems to be tailored toward curating the electorate. And you're now starting to see CEOs, high-ranking African-Americans in the corporate world, high-ranking people in the entertainment world saying, maybe Georgia is a place where we ought not do business. And that will be probably the most salient dynamic in the short and medium term in terms of how people react to this bill in Georgia.
Is that a potential model for other Republican-led states? There are hundreds of these measures, you know, across the country. And I just wonder whether there's going to be a kind of concerted strategy to counteract what the Republicans are trying to do. You know, Raphael Warnock, the first Black U.S. senator ever elected from Georgia, won in a special election. And so he's going to be running for a full term next year.
Right. And, you know, part of this is that Georgia is, one, embarrassed as a state in the Deep South that was expected to go for Trump and did not. Although, if you were in Georgia, going back as far as 2018, there were Republicans who thought that that Trump's support in the state was curiously soft. And so nothing he did in the interim improved that situation. The next race will be different, partly because this law will be in effect. And in addition, you know, Georgia is being looked at because they are piloting these laws that other places would be interested in emulating. Now, I don't know that the financial element is going to be the same because Georgia in general and Atlanta in particular pride themselves on being the kind of economic engines of the Deep South. And there are 18 Fortune 500 companies doing business in Georgia. They have $10 billion annually that they get in revenue from Hollywood productions and film and television shows that are shooting there. All of those things could go away, or much of that could go away as a result of a really controversial and racially inflammatory bill like this, which is now, I should say, a law. And so what happens in Georgia is interesting, but that might not be the strategy that works every place where these bills are being introduced.
And are there other strategies that you've seen sort of come into effect by the NAACP and other groups to fight this trend?
Sure. There are lawsuits that are going up always. You know, there's going to be a kind of blizzard of paper that will come out of this. And, you know, that will be a part of the narrative as well. And then, you know, the grassroots organizing that people are trying to do to find ways to counter, you know, what the impact of these laws will be. And so, like, what we saw in the last election was a real concerted push to make sure people understood how to vote absentee. You may see grassroots efforts on the same sort of thing, that if people can't vote absentee, what are the best times to vote? What are the things that people can do? We also saw a reduction in Sunday voting, not as severe as had been anticipated, but Sunday is historically in early voting a very big time for African-American voters because people would go straight from church to the polls. And, you know, people are trying to figure out exactly what the response will be. And that a lot of that work is still being figured out.
Thanks so much, Jelani. I know it's a busy day for you.
Thank you.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.